everybody, and welcome to the series of lectures and presentations that we have as part of the Conspiracy and Democracy project, which is funded by the Leverhulme Trust. It's a five-year project. We're well into our second year, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Aronovich to give a lecture. He is the author of this book, Voodoo Histories, The Role of Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. He studies modern history at Oxford, briefly, because he failed the German language exam, shortly after which Oxford abolished the German language and other foreign language exams. He went
suspicious,
to Manchester. Very suspicious. He went to Manchester, where he took a degree in modern history in 1978. And he was a member of the notorious University Challenge team that answered all the questions with either Trotsky, Marx, Lenin, or Che Guevara in protest at Oxbridge being allowed, as it were, in toto, 60-odd teams, whereas each other university was only one. Since then, he's become a very well-known journalist. He's won a number of prizes, the Orwell Prize for Political Journalism, What the Papers Say, Columnist of the Year. He's worked for a range of newspapers. He's now best known as a weekly columnist for The Times. He's chairman of Index on Censorship, and he's also well known for TV and radio programs. So please welcome David Aronovich.
Very much. I'm immensely impressed when I saw the programme for what was being done here, and more impressed than you. I've had to a family emergency. It's the earliest walkout I've ever made. We all come to the earth today. I'm very impressed, and of course I would be, because as any conspiracy theorist worth their salt will tell you, you are part of the conspiracy. You have been funded by shadowy organisations with lots of money in order to cast doubt upon the many and various legitimate and well-sourced and infinitely researched claims that people have to make about the secret ways in which our society is run, and your job essentially is to shoot them down. And whose interest is that in? Well, of course, it's in the interest of the people who would like their activities covered up. So, in that sense, you are the modern Illuminati, you are the Bilderberg group, you are in this room together, so we're all together, so we can speak, since we're all part of the conspiracy. We can admit that it's all true, every word of it. The reason why the lecture has the titles that it does is not because I actually want to talk extensively about the conspiracy theories that emerged after the Scottish referendum, but simply because they were more or less the latest. And since almost every week somebody, in fact almost every day, somebody will tweet me something saying, you need to update your book, you need to write the next version of the book, and so on. I mean, almost literally every day, because something happens. In a way, a lot of what I'm doing is an updating of, or refinement of, things that I've already either thought or learned along the way, and so on, or theories that I have constructed myself, and so on. And it's fair to say, and you already know it, that we can speculate endlessly about the psychology of conspiracy theorists and of conspiracy theory, etc. But by and large, intelligent speculation is mostly what we've got until that fabulous day when we honestly can say that neuroscience is able to tell us precisely what is happening in our brains and why. Until that day comes along, what we are involved in is the intelligent speculation business. So I hope to kind of contribute, in a sense, to your intelligent speculation. Probably, actually, I'll diminish it very slightly. In which case, you can put me straight. So let's start with the latest slew of conspiracy theories in Scotland, because not because there's anything absolutely unique about them, but because they make a very interesting and useful point about a certain species of conspiracy theory. And for in terms of the what you might describe as the rationale for having them, for them being there, for them existing. Just to remind you, almost within hours of the vote being declared after September the 18th, on September the 19th, a campaign became underway to try and get the Electoral Commission of the government to hold a recount because of claims that the ballot was rigged. And a number of pieces of evidence were reduced to the notion that the ballot was rigged. Some people had seen postal votes. Well, actually, they do see samples of the postal vote. Tellers for each side see that to ensure that there's a that there's a proper process going away, going on. Scrutineers, effectively, that there were strange unmarked ballot papers which didn't have any form of number code on them, and that consequently these were almost certainly being discounted from the count. In other words, people were given, had been given effectively false ballots which went automatically into the spoil pile. There were a significant number of claims like this, and none of them turned out to be the Electoral Commission answered each and every point about them fairly easily, as you would expect them to be. Some of them were based on assumptions about where things were on counting tellers' tables temporarily, which was simply the product of people not knowing what the system for counting votes were and where they sat temporarily. And the Electoral Commission was forced into an explanation. But it didn't stop up to 90,000 people signing an online petition to hold a re-vote or an investigation. There were significant theories about the idea that there was a very large secret oil field had been discovered that the Westminster government were trying to suppress the information about because they wanted to give a skewed impression of what an independent Scotland's future economic prospects were like, so as to make more people more economically pessimistic about what would happen if there was a separate Scotland. So there was the, and a number of things were reduced to, for that suggestion. People were said to have let slip at various meetings, various comments that people had made were taken to mean this. Actually, the sort of usual kind of rumble, small rumble of stuff, which is. Constructed as evidence in these sorts of circumstances when people call upon whatever it is they have available, and the reasons that I'll come on to in a moment. And then the third strain was the MI5 strain, which had been given some kind of credibility in June, or it started in June, with a former deputy leader of the Scottish National Party, Jim Sillars, well to the left of the SNP, and probably a slightly marginal figure in today's Scottish National Party, but nevertheless one of the sort of grand old men of Scottish left politics, who in essence said two things. Firstly, he said he thought that when J.K. Rowling had come out for a no vote, come out against independence, and there was then a kind of flurry of what they would call cybernats flaming her online, kind of sort of low level of abusive tweeting and so on. And this played rather badly for the Yes campaign. Sillars speculated that this was MI5 essentially kind of constructing cybernats in order to do this sort of thing. And he said two things really, which also tend to be kind of embedded in most conspiracy theories that I know of, which is one, well, this is what you would expect MI5 to do if they were doing their job anyway. I have an argument from sort of deep structural principle. MI5's job is to save the nation. They would regard saving the nation as meaning the Scots should have independence, and therefore they would use covert ways. It's logical. It makes sense that this is what MI5 would do. And then second, which is also part of him, he happened to know of an MI5 agent who had come to Edinburgh. I should imagine there are quite a few MI5 agents who come to Edinburgh, because quite probably quite a few of them are from Edinburgh. And actually, those of us with a kind of, you know, some kind of long-term level of interest in Scotland's contribution to Great Britain might be aware that contributions to organisations like MI5 are actually probably substantial rather than insubstantial. But nevertheless, he said this, and people started talking about the idea that there was actually a kind of MI5 role in the boat. And of course, this all became very, very substantial on September the 19th. Now, the reason why these are particularly interesting, the reason why people's attachment to them was interesting, was firstly because a fairly large number of people very suddenly attached themselves to things that we would normally think of as being conspiracy theories. This doesn't always happen. By and large, what you're talking about is a bit more of a marinade of people than a kind of sudden surge of people believing in a particular form of conspiracy theory. So it's relatively unusual. But the thing that animated these series of beliefs, and you can see it online when you see the kind of comments that people leave underneath some of the petitions and so on, was a sense of absolute incredulity that their side had lost. Very, very straightforward and simple. They did not believe the polls, except the poll that said they were ahead. They were certain, and people stated it, because of the numbers of posters for the Yes campaign and the numbers so far outstripped the numbers of the No posters, because the enthusiasm, the outward enthusiasm and level of activity on the part of the Yes campaign that they saw was so much greater than that of the No campaign, it was inconceivable, and people would put it in terms of being inconceivable, that Yes lost. And yet it had. Now, under those circumstances, you in this essence have three explanations. One explanation is that people didn't want independence. Okay. I.e., you lost the argument and you lost the vote. This is a very hard thing to take, particularly, let's say, in circumstances where people have been politically active for the first time and have become incredibly enthusiastic about it. In 1983, in the election that Labour was Labour's worst loss since the First World War, I will recall, and some of the older people here may recall as well, the feeling that there was amongst the Labour Party that the polls were wrong. And the polls were wrong because there was an incredible amount of enthusiasm, it was felt, at the public meetings that Michael Foot, the then leader of the Labour Party, was attending, and that Labour at last had, in the manifesto of 1983, which was called by other Labour people the longest suicide note in history, but that actually it was the most socialist, it was the most radical, it was the most left-wing and so on. So there were people who actually did become pretty convinced that there was a disconnect between what they were seeing and what, if you like, the official organs of the press and the polls, etc., were telling them. And somewhere in this disconnect, something lay. Now, actually, funnily enough, nobody then constructed a conspiracy theory off the back of the 1983 elections. And we might like to speculate about why that is, or at least not one that I can recall happening in quite the same way. There was, Tony Benn was available to say that actually what it meant was it was very good, because if 8.5 million people had voted for such a left-wing manifesto, that meant that there were 8.5 million wonderful people around who were willing to go for socialism. This was a kind of compensation. And you can see aspects of that in the Scottish Nationalist notion of the 45, which quite a lot of people are talking about. We're members of the 45. In other words, defeat is actually victory. Interestingly, the No campaign don't go around with 55 on them. And we can come back to that later, because one of the things we can think about is why it is inconceivable, I think, that a yes vote would have led to a series of no-sided conspiracy theories. I mean, it's extremely unlikely. We can speculate about it, but I think it is extremely unlikely. In other words, we were definitely going to win, and it was taken away from us. Now, the second way in which you could explain this was the kind of version of they lied to us. And that was obviously very popular amongst, if you like, kind of more rational nationalists. It was, or a version of that is, it was only old people voted no, and they effectively, because they're scared, old people are scared and kind of let the young down, they'll die pretty soon anyway, and when they do, we'll have independence. I'm not even really sure that paraphrase is crude. I think it's actually pretty much what people were thinking and so on. And then there is the conspiracy theory. The conspiracy theory that says these things were actually done, the vote was actually stolen, MI5 actually did intervene, and there actually is a bloody great oil field that they didn't tell you about, which if you'd known about it, then in that case you would have voted differently. So that's a kind of physical expression of the accusation by the nationalists that the vote effectively was based on a lie, but it's actually given sort of organised expression, somebody organised to do it. It wasn't just a matter of fibs told in argument or arguments that were false, it was actually something that was concretely done. It is actually related to another kind of conspiracy theory which you often see, which kind of low-level conspiracy theory, which football fans but in particular suffer from, which is the we was robbed syndrome. And you will see even football managers who've been in the game for a long time who will insist that over the course of a season referees have got it in for them. It's never explained particularly why Arsenal or Accrington Stanley should be the particular victim of referees, and you could, I suppose, just about make a case that they were so pissed off referees with the way in which certain managers behave that they might just over time want to punish them and so on. But it's a pretty difficult stretch, and actually when you begin to analyse what's actually happened, it begins to slip away. Nevertheless, very many football fans will give vent to the notion that somehow or other they were deprived of victory by a malign officialhood working deliberately against them. So in that sense, it's a relative of that. Now, of course, what then happens is that despite the fact that there is a kind of degree of irrationality in the position of the disappointed yes voter, who cannot quite accept that actually everybody in every house that didn't have a poster on it also voted, and an awful lot of them were voting no, but didn't necessarily want to tell every yes voter or yes person who went up with a kind of gleaming Mormon smile to them about yes, it would disappoint them and so on, but you know, for very obvious reasons. These are lessons that you learn in the kind of hard business of losing elections, frankly. If you've ever canvassed for an election that you've lost, it is the sort of lesson that, you know, you gradually realise that in all these houses are people who also have votes, and guess what, an awful lot of them don't agree with you, even sometimes when they say that they do. But in your, and this is the next feature, in your online echo chambers, you of course filter out the contrary argument to a large extent. It can come in again in your sort of disputes on Twitter and so on. But the people who you are talking to most, the sites you are going to most, and Cass Sunstein did a study of all this in the States back in 2009-2010 about the way in which increasingly in the States, we talk about it, but it's also true here, people keep to their own community of belief. And that could be as true of the skeptics, for instance, what we call skeptics here, as it could be true of conspiracy theorists. You actually talk to each other yourself, not talk to each other, you talk to your group, you settle matters, you firm matters up, and it's only then that you kind of sally forth with your truth already. And I mean, of course, the conspiracy theorists would say, well, isn't that exactly what you're doing here? And it's a question that, you know, you had to engage with. So the echo chambers and also the reflexive logic, which effectively says that any contrary argument is a sign of the very thing that the person is making the argument about. Now, the Scottish conspiracy theory is not the only kind of type of conspiracy theory which is getting some play at the moment. You will have noticed, if you are an absorber of the mainstream media, the MSM, as you must now call it, that there has been a considerable fuss after the suicide of a woman called Brenda Leyland in the last fortnight. Brenda Leyland was fingered for being one of the people contributing to a site making accusations about Caden Jerry McCann. The McCann conspiracy theory is a complete subgenus of conspiracy theories, and one which quite often happens, but it's one that gives an insight into another set of motivations, because the point that I'm making about the Scottish nationalists is always the question of, if you like, the preferred truth. To me, a conspiracy theory is the decision to believe and espouse a theory involving a conspiracy which is a less plausible explanation than the explanations that are already available to you. That's essentially what a conspiracy theory is, as far as I'm concerned. And therefore, it involves a decision, as actually most beliefs involve a decision, to believe X rather than Y. For various reasons, X is more palatable to you than Y is. It becomes something that you would rather depend upon. So, obviously, in the case of nationalists, or rather people who were in favour of a yes vote, became very strongly in favour of it, it is almost unbearable to believe that all these Scots just simply don't agree with you. Simple as that. How can it be? And so, some of you construct an alternative version of why it's happened, and that some of that alternative version involves conspiracy. Some of it doesn't, but some of it does. Well, the same is true with the McCann. So, the kind of, for years and years, those of us working in journalism have been subjected to, if you like, a kind of low-level buzz from McCann conspiracy theories. Essentially, what they hold is that the child was, in effect, murdered by her parents, and the truth of that is covered up by various organs of the state and so on. Some go so far as to say that because Jerry McCann is a Freemason, it's the Freemasons have got together and made, and actually I have no idea whether he is a Freemason or not, so you better not repeat that, but it was just one that passed by me last week. It's a Freemason. The Freemasonry and the police and other people have effectively protected them from what is the obvious truth, which is that actually they did away with their own child and somehow or other in that 20 minutes without even anybody else noticing. And everything else to cover up, including their friends. They now call them, after the restaurant, I can't remember what the restaurant was called, but they call them the Pride, there was nine, who are the parents who came together, they're all lying, they're all in it together, they've all made the agreement, they're all kind of covering up. And somebody like Brenda Leyland believed this passionately. And the people who believe it passionately. I mean, absolutely passionately. It's related to another form of recent conspiracy theory, which we'll come on to in a moment, believe absolutely passionately. So the question you ask yourself is, given the inherent likelihood in the theories which they espouse, well, obviously, the one thing that the theory about the McCanns having done it deals with is the incredible psychic problem of where the hell the child got to. The not knowing where Madeleine McCann is mildly unbearable in itself. But for a certain kind of psychology, I would imagine, it's particularly unbearable. We can speculate about the circumstances under which somebody might find it trebly, quadruply intolerable to have a situation whereby a child's disappearance from a hotel room cannot be accounted for. Just can't be accounted for. In a way, it's a relative of the MH17 theories about the disappeared aircraft. How can it possibly be that there is no explanation for, no possible explanation, but no accepted cause for a disappeared airliner or a disappeared young girl on a beach holiday? So, somebody begins to float a theory, some people attach themselves to it, the websites proliferate, people read them, people cite them, and so on. They harden themselves up. So by the time you get tweeted by, or you come onto the radar of McCann conspiracy theorists, as soon as they tweet you, you get it both barrels, all of a sudden. And so as soon as I'd written something last week about Brenda Leyland, there 10 of them were, all using the same hashtag, so they knew each other was doing it, because this was the hashtag that they regularly visited, and so you would suddenly become part of a pack. And if you were interested in the McCann case, you would be able to find them, or they'd be able to find you if you cited them, and that would be, if you like, a kind of entry point into what is, at the end of the day, a fairly kind of minor conspiracy theory, but nevertheless, one that is kind of has been in the news in the course of the last couple of weeks. But this too has its relationship in, it seems to me, in psychology. It seems to have some relationship to the other major underlying conspiracy theories of the last few months, which is the notion of a powerful political paedophile network. Now, I'm not in a position to say to you that there are how many MPs may have been paedophiles or not paedophiles, and of course there's some questions to be asked about the working definitions of paedophile. For instance, is a man who had sex with a 16-year-old boy when that was illegal a paedophile, given that we now consider it to be perfectly legal behaviour? And some of these issues may shade, frankly, may very well shade over into an accusation that may shade over into that. But nevertheless, as it was put by the Labour MP Tom Watson in the House of Commons, he was talking about whether or not there was evidence of a powerful paedophile network that reached into the government and into Number 10. Whatever it was that he had in his mind at that moment, it opened an absolute flood of such accusations, particularly in the press, completely, often barely even examined. Accusations made about almost entirely about dead people. Some of them also, when they're made about live, with the objective of attempting essentially to flush other accusers out. You may have seen the case of Paul Gambaccini, the DJ, who was arrested some time ago, but now the police are not going to take any further action. It looks quite likely that what the police did in that instance, and you can see why they do, is they make publicity about an accusation about somebody so that other people can come forward to corroborate it. And if there is corroboration, then in that case they may press ahead with charges. You can see what the advantage of that is. You can also see what the problem with it is. The advantage is that there may indeed be such people who have also been abused by an abuser and so on and have suffered in silence and now have asked them to come out. There is also a fairly obvious problem, which is you could dignify a vexatious complaint and encourage people to jump on it. And it has become a kind of article of faith among some people that there is no such thing ever as a forced complaint. This is not true, unfortunately. There can be such a thing. They may be rare, that rare compared with the numbers of cases of uninvestigated complaints and so on, but nevertheless, they certainly do exist. So you had a capacity under those circumstances, a situation whereby you could make virtually any kind of complaint about the dead, and sometimes some complaints about the living, which the police could investigate, which would, if you like, kind of further the notion that there was some great kind of paedophile network. Some of the stories which have appeared in this light, not all of them, but some of them, are utterly bizarre. I mean, the levels of bizarreness, let me just give you one, which is the accusations made by a guy called Anthony Gilberthorpe, which appeared in the Mirror in July. And essentially what Gilberthorpe said is, I was a procurer of boys for sex at Tory party conferences. And he then went on to name a series of Tory grandees, all of them dead, who he said had taken part in essentially quasi-public orgies, including in the Grand Hotel in Brighton, the night before the Brighton bomb, which must be just about the most security locked down or investigated hotel and timing in the history of hotels and timings and so on. But nevertheless, Gilthorpe said that's what had happened. And the people that he had included were Sir Keith Joseph, described by one of the blog sites, websites, which enjoys such conspiracies, as part of the Kosher Nostra, because there isn't a conspiracy theory yet invented, except maybe the Scottish one that doesn't appear to have, for somebody, a Jewish dimension. and so, like this one did for this particular person. So Keith Joseph, Peter Brook, as far as I know, both Keith Joseph and Peter Brook were heterosexuals. And there were people about whom there was never, ever any rumour at the time. Now this doesn't completely rule it out, but it does make it vanishingly unlikely. Compared with which, Anthony Gilberthorpe was the man who set up the MP Piers Merchant for the Daily Mirror in 1997 by luring his MP friend into, effectively, into a flat where he filmed him having sex with a young woman who he'd been set up with in a woman, and earned £25,000 from the Daily Mirror. Now, you might regard this as a slightly more indicative pattern of behaviour than that of Sir Keith Joseph, previously unknown homosexual paedophile at a Tory party conference and so on. Personally, I would say that the balance of likelihood operated against Gilderthorpe, but maybe I have my own psychological reasons for wanting to believe that. Interestingly, that the structures of these encounters are very like the sorts of moral panics we had at the time of the belief in satanic child abuse. Back in the 90s, the idea that there was a lot of child abuse, which was essentially organised around satanic ritual, which slightly fell apart when it was discovered that there was actually no evidence whatsoever for any satanic ritual. And despite the fact that there had been claims made about babies being sacrificed and so on, and this was widely reported. So there is a kind of also sort of subgenus of conspiracy theories which come pretty close, if you like, to that kind of exotica. And by that moment, we're beginning to begin to shade into alien abduction, as you can see. You're quite close to the structures of belief and structure of thought which gives you alien abduction. A significant proportion of the American population apparently believe that they have been abducted by aliens. Most of them believe that they have been probed genitally, and most of the people who believe that are women, about 80% apparently. Do they actually believe that? Do they actually believe, because this is where you step over from a theory to a claim of direct experience and so on. I find that one a very difficult one to deal with, but actually having been completely mad in hospital for 4 days myself, I think I understand slightly better the psychotic experience than once I did. This paedophile network, however, is then played back into the Scottish boat itself, so that Westminster's supposed toleration of paedophile networks becomes an actual argument some people make for Scotland becoming independent, so it can be independent of all those paedophiles down in Westminster. And you have to say at this point that there is a utility, an almost cynical utility, for some conspiracy theories. We see it particularly where governments espouse conspiracy theories, obviously. But actually, other people can, sometimes conspiracy theory is a matter of genuine belief. Occasionally, as with the moon landings, it's more a matter of sort of adolescent playfulness, really. I know something you don't know, etc. But sometimes it is actually a semi-conscious use of an argument, deployment of an argument, in effect, almost to kind of bamboozle people. Now, when I say that, I'm aware that I'm almost creating conspiracy theory of conspiracy theories there. But when you look at something like Russia Today, or the RT, and the way in which the Russian mainstream media now operates, its own MSN, which is on television at least, entirely now government-run, it has a very firm belief, or espouses a very firm belief, in some of the more esoteric anti-Western conspiracy theories. And it is quite hard to believe that the serious diplomats and the serious communicators in the Kremlin and elsewhere believe this stuff, and yet they allow it to happen. And in that sense, the structure of the utility of the conspiracy theory begins to be a little bit like Jewish conspiracy theories about Jews have been for Arab governments traditionally, which is you don't necessarily have to believe them yourself, but they certainly don't do any harm when they appear in our Quran. In 2003, I went to Cairo and interviewed one of Mubarak's leading advisors, a guy called Baz, a tiny little man, very, very clever guy, but essentially, the brains behind the Egyptian authoritarian government. And it was at a time when clearly the Egyptian government wanted to get away from the conspiracy theories about Jews in Israel. They were causing them embarrassment, it looked bad in the West and so on, and they had begun a little kind of campaign to roll back in their own media But of course now they're facing some kind of difficulties, which is that a lot of the people who espouse the conspiracy theories firmly believed them and didn't believe the government when it said that they weren't true, and they were having some sorts of problems. But up until then, there had been a degree of utility. Now, in addition to that, I mean, if we just talk about the most proximate conspiracy theories, you then get, if you like, what you might call the omnivorous conspiracy theorists, of whom Naomi Wolf is now the most illustrious, famous author, sold lots and lots of books. Initially, people thought those books were quite sensible. As time went on, those books began to be more bizarre. But right now, there doesn't seem to be a conspiracy theory that Naomi Wolf does not espouse. Ebola is a confected disease constructed so that you can bring in more controls on people in America, being a kind of classic case in point. Foley, James Foley, was not actually beheaded. That too is a confection by governments and so on. If you look very, very carefully at the videos, you can see, etc. I mean, I had a penny for every time I've heard that about some other situation. If you look really carefully, see, it's just, you know, shadows on the moon, blah, 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 blah. It's not really happening, etc. There's always something to find if you want to find it. But what we're interested here in a way is what that would be about. And I mean, this comes to the point, really. I discovered a new conspiracy theorist today, a guy called Mark Crispin Miller, who's very much in this kind of line, who is the professor of media studies at New York University, who has been arguing that Foley is a fake, and actually he's identified amongst the parents being interviewed with Foley two distinct set of parents, both who claim to be the parents. In other words, not only is there a kind of fake Foley thing going on, but there's a kind of incompetent fake Foley thing going on, whereby you put up people who are, he can always see, are not really the parents that you have shown in the previous emanation of the Foley thing. And if you think that's odd, it's not that odd. Back in the mid-60s, after the assassination of JFK, and when it was becoming theory time for everybody, a Professor Popkin, who was an important professor of philosophy in the States, constructed a theory which he wrote at length in the New York Review of Books, which is an august journal by anybody's standards. And his theory was that there had been two Lee Harvey Oswalds, a Lee Harvey Oswald bad Lee Harvey Oswald, and a Lee Harvey Oswald good Lee Harvey Oswald, and one had been a doppelganger of the other. He said he had to have this theory, he said, because nothing else explained to his satisfaction what had happened. In other words, the explanation given by the Warren Commission could not be accepted, and once you couldn't accept it, you then got into the situation whereby you had to construct something of such incredible complexity. And that, unfortunately, was not, because he, and at least he was honest about it, he said, I feel I have to, because quite a lot of conspiracy theory argument will come up as, I'm only asking questions, I don't have a theory myself, I'm just saying that the official version doesn't work, etc., we're being sold a pup, etc. Popkin felt the intellectual requirement to come up with a theory, and the one he had to come up with, the only one that fitted, as far as he was concerned, was that there were two Lee Harvey Oswalds, and one was substituted for the other. But the reason why I raised Naomi Wolf was because it is a kind of, and this comes back to the question I raised at the beginning, and then I'll stop. It is also arising out of a self-image of insurgency. There is a kind of insurgent quality to the notion that you will reject what most other people accept, that you will see something that other people don't see. It is a bit like a kind of intellectual version of wearing a Che Guevara t-shirt and meaning it, in that sense. You know, it says something about you, and it says something about your attitude towards the world, that you are not so accepting of what everybody else is accepting that you are not prepared to be not just critical but super critical of everything that you hear. And what that means is a determined effort to look for the anomalies or for the structures in arguments which will give you some space to suggest that something really nefarious is going on. Now, in the context of a Western country like Britain, or America. These things can cause a certain amount of disturbance. If you think about the birth of theories about Obama, that he was somehow not American and that his Hawaiian birth registration had been faked and that actually he's a Kenyan and therefore not eligible to be president, which were made by much the same kind of people who used to run theories about the criminal Clinton gang and how they'd had people bumped off and so on, and theories which went very big in the States. And in the Clinton case were actually part of the early days of the internet. There was some of the very, very earliest online discussions and constructions were around the Clinton thing, were done mostly by right-wing Republicans and so on. But as with the JFK thing, if the JFK, if you like, sort of paranoid theories grew on the left side of arguments that had actually originated on the American populist right, and by and large they did, lack of agency, for instance, you know, the idea of patsies, the idea of Manchurian candidates, and so on. So you had the kind of structures of thought which gave them to them, and they were then taken over. When the right was insurgent, it was one kind of an argument aimed at one set of people. When the left is insurgent, another set of people kind of tend to take it over. And by and large, what we have now in this country is, and America, is, if you like, a kind of left insurgency. It tends to come from a radical critique of capitalism that goes along with it. However, and this is my final point, whilst that can, in a sense, is always going to be a minority supporter, is likely to be a minority support in countries like America and Britain, unfortunately, exactly the same arguments deployed in places like Pakistan are not minority supports at all. Their majority, it's what the majority get to believe and will, and the Western sources can often be cited as significant evidence for the idea that Foley hasn't been killed by IS, and actually the whole thing has been constructed by the Americans, that the Jews really are, and Israel really is responsible for doing almost all these things that they say Muslims do. And that is an incredibly dangerous form of delusion. So, finally, some of the things that we talk about here may be strange and funny in the context of complaints about the Scottish election, but mutated and transferred and translated to other places, they actually are very much more problematic. And I'll leave it there, especially for the moment, and we'll talk.